All nurses to the nurses station.
Lawless country people, all real close family. Lately, some of my kinfolk don't get around too good, you see. When that doctor asked them, "Son, how'd you get in this condition?" They says, "Hey, sawbones, I'm just carrying on an old family tradition." Wanna know, Doc, why do you think I got some pain in my joints? He is playing hard in this life that's too short. When that doctor asked me, "Son, how'd you get in this condition?" I says, "Hey, sawbones, I'm just carrying on it all." Tell me all about it, Doc.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Hey Sawbones, My Story, My Passion. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Sawbones Molly, orthopedic surgeon, entrepreneur, business owner, but most importantly, loving husband, father of three young, busy boys and very active boys. And tonight, this is the episode from Down Under. I have a good colleague, good friend that finally got to meet in person. I feel like I've gotten to know him over the past several years through social media, particularly LinkedIn, the platform that's kind of like a professional Facebook. And he's an orthopedic surgeon, a very, very bright, very talented surgeon, and just a great guy. And I've gotten to know him quite a bit over the past, 15 hours or so as we've kind of talked throughout the day and learned more about his Australian culture, his background. But without further ado, Dr. Ilan Freeman.
Thank you very much.
How are you?
Yeah.
Thanks for making the trip. I can honestly say that you've traveled the furthest.
Of all your guests, though, huh?
Yeah. Now, yeah. Granted, this wasn't, you didn't travel here for this, but.
No, it's part of it, but. Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Have you had any other internationals, or I'm the first non-American?
No, so I've had a couple. There was a soccer coach from where I went to undergrad, John Melody. He's Irish, mm-hmm. So everybody else speaks very boring. And I've had a female physician from India on, so I think you're maybe the third, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So you're going to sound the smartest, though. With the Australian / kind of British accent. So, and you're in town because you came and visited Dr. Keith Barron and myself the past couple of days, but you're going to the AAHKS meeting, which is, Jay, you can put that right here. That stands for AAHKS, stands for American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons. It's kind of a nationally recognized organization of fellowship trained hip and knee surgeons, where that's really all we talk about for several days at this meeting. So, but you've been here. You've been to the United States many times.
Many times, but never to the Midwest.
Yeah, this is it.
The culture's good. People are friendly. That's been great.
I think it's easy. People are nice here and helpful. And not that they're not from other areas, but I just feel like this area is just like, it's pretty wholesome.
Yeah, so. I think it seems like authentic.
Yeah.
Other places feel people trying a little bit too hard, but here it just sort of feels natural and authentic, and
yeah,
that's good.
Means a lot. So what I typically do with our guests is like the first couple minutes is like give our guests the 30,000 foot view of who Ilan Freeman is, like where you grew up, kind of your background, what kind of got you interested in, orthopedics, and then we'll get into the details when we get into more of the questions.
Yeah, so I born in South Africa, grew up in South Africa. My dad's an anesthesiologist. We actually work together still, but they made the decision to move to Australia. This was, apartheid was breaking down, which was a good thing, but it was a very tumultuous time to be a white South African and a lot of violence. So they decided to move and got pulled across when I was 16, got thrown in, did high school over there, medical school, and then obviously orthopedics, and then landed up doing an international fellowship in the UK, met a French surgeon who does anterior hips, got into that sort of niche. But yeah, so in residency, I landed up working with a German surgeon, a German trauma surgeon, who's a great surgeon but couldn't speak much English. And so he wanted to do research, and he had all these really shitty papers that he, or good research, but really badly written papers. And so when you're trying to get into the program or trying to get into the residency, you've got to do a lot of research. So this guy had done all this research, poorly worded, couldn't make sense of it, and said to me, looking for someone who could sort of fix his research for him. So I landed up sort of, you know, editing and fixing research and getting a lot of publications out of that. And then doing trauma. And initially it was just sort of, you know, satisfying to just fix things. You know, people come in, you know, car accident completely smashed up, and the gratification of the immediate fix of orthopedics. And after a while you realize you may not want to be a trauma surgeon forever. Yeah. You can kind of get the balance of fixing and still be doing something a little bit more in control of your lifestyle a little bit. But it's actually the introduction through trauma, through orthopedic trauma and research and clinical, and then sort of kind of realizing that maybe elective orthopedics was a good, happy medium.
Was that in Australia that, yeah, you were working with a German surgeon?
Yeah, German-based surgeon who ran the country's biggest trauma center.
Okay.
So it was just, just crazy mass, you know, level one trauma. And then from that into orthopedics, and then exposed to, you know, elective stuff and arthroplasty, and chose orthopedics is a great area of medicine that, you know, you get very quick results. You make profound differences very quickly. We don't generally have chronic long-term problems. Obviously preventive health is important, but that's not the focus. We're not trying to prevent a heart attack. We're actually fixing a problem that we can get.
Sure.
So patients love it. Patients like you as a doctor, because they can see that you can make a profound difference in, you know, in weeks.
Yeah.
Nowadays, sometimes even in days. So
that was definitely one of the things that kind of drew me to that, because medicine in general wasn't something I was interested in dealing or managing chronic diseases where, hey, I'm going to give you a blood pressure medication, we're going to adjust your dosages and follow some lab values. Yeah.
And if you've done well, you won't have a heart attack. So it's, you know, we're more sort of, you know, we'll fix your problem.
Yeah. It was a little bit more concrete. Yeah. And like you said, it was like pretty cut and dry. Like, bones broke, I fixed it. Knees are arthritic, I fixed it. The results are not immediate, but pretty quick. Yeah. And the patients are generally extremely happy and satisfied. And it's rewarding, right? I mean, it's a fun, plus it's really fun to working with your hands and in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, there's a perception amongst other doctors that, you know, orthopod, big brute, you know, fixed problem. But actually, there's a lot of emerging between, you know, technology, there's a lot of, you know, intellectual thinking behind things, you know, trying to improve products, trying to improve implants. So it's not just, you know, me Thor hammer fix.
Sure.
It's a nice mix of a couple of different disciplines.
Yeah. And I mean, I follow you quite a bit on LinkedIn, and I feel like we have very similar passions, and you really enjoy problem solving with whether it's, for instance, kinematic alignment, right? You're looking for an easier, better way system to do the operation reproducibly, right? So that it's not having to recut the tibia a bunch of times and things like that. And similarly, myself, I like tinkering, I like woodworking, I like designing things, whether it's architecture or implants or
tables,
instruments, tables, rooms, offices, things like that. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the kind of the layout of this podcast, where it's kind of a mutual interview. Obviously, my guests have heard a lot about me, so we can kind of go through mine questions first. You can ask me the three business and three personal, and then we'll spin the tables, because I want to spend a lot more time learning more about you, and I'm sure my guests want to hear that too. So fire away. We'll do business stuff first.
Well, I guess, I mean, today I sort of met you, saw your practice, and realized how many mouths you feed, how many people you're managing. And, you know, I know from, you know, my job, I'm just, you know, I'm trying to operate, seeing patients. I have my two or three staff, and that's enough. It's a different level to be managing so many people and trying to manage the business side of things, you know, without really a business background.
Yeah, so. No degree.
No degree, right? So, I mean, the leap from being a clinician who just does your work to a business owner, part ownership at a hospital, huge clinic that you've envisioned during COVID. How do you leap from just doing your job as a clinician to suddenly you're a company and you're managing all these people?
Yeah, so I was always kind of like a big thinker and a dreamer. Obviously, it did not happen overnight, right? Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, right out of my training and my fellowship, I would not have been a good business owner at all. And quite frankly, when I first started the business, I don't think I was a good business owner either because I didn't know what it took. I mean, I was able to survive and be successful, but it was a lot of hard-earned lessons, like, through the school of hard knocks, so to speak. But in 2013, 2014, I was 3-4 years into my practice at that point, and I kind of was going through this soul-searching period with my best friend, Jared Oakes, who is a real estate attorney in Cleveland. And he was very successful at what he was doing. I was building a practice at that point. I think I was doing maybe 250 to 300 joints a year. So not small by any means, not anywhere near as what I do now, but we both kind of were like, I feel like we were put on this planet to do more. And it really came centered around wellness. And we created this concept in this company called Whole Health Communities. It wasn't Whole Health Orthopedic Institute. It wasn't Whole Health Joint Replacement Institute. It was Whole Health Communities. And we both had married girls from Michigan, Metro Detroit area. And we both felt as though, particularly in the United States, we had this issue with chronic disease, right? Metabolic syndrome with obesity and diabetes and hypertension and just chronic diseases that could quite simply and quite frankly be eliminated or significantly reduced by incorporating proper education and incorporating positive lifestyles. So what our goal was, we were going to create a community, and we looked at 60 some sites in the Metro Detroit area to kind of start our first site. And we were looking at massive properties. Like the smallest property, I think, was 200 acres. The largest was 500-600 acres. We finally settled on one geographical location that was about close to 500 acres. And there was a lake there. There was a metro park close to it. And he being a real estate attorney and me being a physician, it was going to be a wellness community where we had housing developments. We had single family homes. We had multifamily homes. We had businesses. We had a downtown area. We had a little canal district with restaurants, bistros. But then my part was the wellness piece. So we were going to do a facility called Complete Care that was a multi-specialty medical facility where we focused on primary care. We had nutritionists, we had dietitians, we had endocrinologists, we had orthopedic surgeons, and we had a surgery center. And we also put a big focus on education. So we weren't having like an elementary school, middle school, high school, but like preschool education where we get the kids very young, teaching them how to eat well. We had a farm to table component where we were going to have like family farms, people could grow their own vegetables and produce, and really try to like make an impact early on in young kids' lives. And literally a year later, we pitched this to Francesco Sicardi in 2014. We had a full business plan. The project was $292 million.
Right.
I didn't have that type of money. Still don't have a fraction of that type of money to be able to fund this. So we needed to go outside to get angel investors, venture capitalists, things like that, and to try to raise funds. And we met a lot of people that were very, very interested, but it was always like, the timing's not right, the this, the that. And lo and behold, Jared got into a new law firm, and my wife and I decided to move to Pennsylvania in 2015, early 2015. So that kind of got put on hold, but like that dreamer side of me was always like thinking big and wanting to do something bigger. And 2017, I decided to start Whole Health, at that point, Joint Replacement Institute, which later turned into Orthopedic Institute because we were just doing hips and knees. And then we added sports medicine and then the Wellness Institute just last year. So it was an evolutionary process. It wasn't easy. It still is not easy, but and my wife, you know, if you look at Whole Health Orthopedic Institute versus Whole Health Communities, this is a little nibble versus that was like a five-course meal. It was massive and it was daunting. And this is obviously something I know a lot more about, orthopedics versus just like the whole building a city, so to speak. But, and just the team too. I have a great leadership team at the practice that helps to keep staff like on track, on engaged. And, yeah, it's been a long process, but a very, very fun process.
So do you think you've ceilinged out, or do you think you'll in 10 years time, there'll be Whole Health Orthopedics Boston, Whole Health Orthopedics California?
Initially, that's what the goals were. But quite frankly, I'm pretty satisfied where things are. And there was a book that one of my red carpet guests recommended to me, Marty Nichols. I don't know if you've met him yet, but he started Physicians First Bank, which is a bank owned by physicians here in the United States. A novel idea, great idea for physicians. Instead of going to this bank or this bank to take out loans, like why not have a bank that you can go to that you actually own so that you're getting something and you're investing in something that you can collect interest on. And it's owned by, you know, hundreds of physicians. And he mentioned this book called Small Giants. And when he came and visited and he came to the clinic, he was so impressed with just like the building and the feel of like the staff, the warmth, the everybody was engaged. It wasn't like take a number, so to speak. It was, hey, how are you doing? Can I get you anything? Can I get you something from the cafe? And he gave me one of the biggest compliments. He goes, you could have been in that book. He's like, you're a small giant. And that was kind of like, maybe this is good. Like bigger's not always better. So what else?
No, that's good. It's just, yeah, like it's, you know, that thing definitely coming from Australia to America is, you know, you arrive and everything's sort of big and cheap, right? You go and you get a meal and it's huge, but the calories aren't great, or the coffees are, you know, the drinks have way too much sugar. Like you're dealing with massive nationwide health problems.
Yeah.
You know, the sodas are huge. Like it's just, I'm blown away. The food is just big.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to deal with these problems of people who are just being exposed to, you know, everyone's got, you know, when I was in Europe, there's no big people because everyone's walking and cycling around everywhere. Like the whole society.
They're all smoking, but it's...
they look good anyway.
Yeah, they do.
But you know, you're trying to like deal with chronic problems in a system that you can't. You can obviously make a difference.
Yeah.
But the system, the problems are bigger than what you and I can fix.
Yeah.
It's just trying to make a little dent in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to just accept that, like, my dent is better than no dent.
Yeah.
So the little things matter to me. And if I can get one patient to stop smoking, which I've been very successful with that, it, like, pain is a very, very strong motivator. And if I say, hey, you want me to do your hip, you want me to do your knee, I'll do it, but I'm not doing it while you're smoking. You have to quit. And you have to quit for 6 weeks, and I'm going to check your codeine levels to make sure that you aren't smoking so you can't just say I've stopped smoking. Or the weight loss program, that's probably the hardest one. It's a tough thing for people to lose weight, but you know, that's something that's probably like my next real passion is, instead of just giving all these orthopedic talks, I really want to start talking about like metabolic issues and generalized wellness issues.
Do you think these new drugs like Ozempic, Wegovy are going to change the landscape of people wearing it down their joints, because they're going to be sort of I know that the weight loss surgeons are war. I mean, there could be a huge shift towards medical management of obesity.
Yeah,
whether people suddenly stop trashing their knees at 50, if we can get their weight down.
I don't think so. Cause, I mean, I feel like I have quite a few patients that I see that aren't obese, yeah. And then I have some patients that are obese that I'm like, oh, they're going to have horrible joints, and I see, you know, some of their X-rays, and it's like, whoa. I feel like arthritis is very much genetic, the predisposition for it. And I don't think these medications that are these like amazing drugs are the end all be all, the panacea of weight loss. I think that they can make a dent, and I think that they can be a kickstart, but truly, I think it needs to be a lifestyle thing. And one of the big things that I've kind of like embraced over the past 14 years was not only like trying to limit my carbohydrates. We had some risotto tonight and bread, which is pretty unusual for me. I'm drinking some wine, but intermittent fasting. I'm a huge advocate for intermittent fasting. I typically eat one meal a day. So I think if we can, people not only eat too much and eat too many processed foods, particularly in this country, things in bags, packages, boxes that aren't natural, aren't whole, aren't healthy, but it's when they're eating it too. So that to me is kind of like that next thing of how do we change that? And it's hard. I mean, it's like trying to re-educate and reprogram a computer, right? That knows one thing, eat and snack. And I think there's too much snacking and too much eating occurring in this country.
Yeah. I'm not sure how it works in the States, but you know, in Australia, there's sort of very high taxes on cigarettes, for example. Like cigarettes are expensive. There's a proposal to put sort of taxes on sugar, and how much of it is, and I guess to talk about it before, how much of things should be, you know, education, personal choice, but personal responsibility, or in the Australian system where the government comes in and tries to legislate health.
Yeah. And I know in Europe too. Yeah. I mean, there's certain artificial sweeteners and, you know, just additives that cannot be used because of the deleterious health effects that they have. Whereas here in the United States, it's just, you see it in every type of food because it's a preservative. It helps to maintain shelf life. It has that sweet like, for instance, like you look at some of the fast food items, whether it's Wendy's or Chick-fil-A or this or that. I'm not picking on any particular company, but they break down, like, it's not just do you follow Dutch Rojas at all on LinkedIn? He's big on this, just like empty calories, right? And you think that this chicken sandwich is a chicken sandwich, but all the other chemicals that are in there that are programmed to make it really, really taste good so that you just become addicted to it. And they have no nutritional values and quite frankly have quite the opposite effect. So I do think that I don't know the answer. I think there should be some legislation on that. Obviously people need to have choice, but I don't think the government should be coming in and telling me like you can or cannot eat French fries, but maybe there's particular oils that can be used to cook French fries that are healthier than say some of the vegetable oils that have caused chronic diseases such as heart disease and a lot of that. So I don't know if that answers your question fully, but
yeah, no, I just sort of, I battle with the role of, you know, libertarian, you know, personal choice versus the role of government.
Yeah.
You know, for example,
like it's gotta be a balance.
Yeah, like, in Australia, for example, they wanted to try and reduce the road toll. The aim is of a zero road toll, but you can't achieve a zero road toll unless everyone drives super slowly. So in areas
when you say road toll, what do you mean by that?
So road fatalities.
Oh,
the aim of the state is literally to have zero road fatalities. It's like a published policy. I don't know what they call it, you know, Project Zero or whatever it is. But they've gone and then reduced the speeding limits everywhere to like 30 miles an hour. Like everything. So there's government legislation to bring down speed limits with the aim of no one gets killed on the road.
But Chen Wen Lu is not following those rules.
It's just, you know, I battle with that. But where does personal responsibility end? And what's the government? You know, do you believe in big government? And obviously with the elections going on, that we haven't heard the result. You know, would you believe in big government, small government? And
yeah, I mean, I think it should be a lot of like, particularly like local government, and I'm not a huge fan of big government. I don't openly speak politics very often, but this is a big day. This is election day. It's, what time is it? It's probably 7:30 or so. So we have no idea who the president is for the next 4 years, but I voted. We got Elon to go in and vote since he didn't need an ID. I'm kidding. But we joked about it.
Could have, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely could have. I went in and I didn't even need my ID. It seems ludicrous to me.
Yeah.
So what else?
Oh, the other thing is orthopedics, right?
Yeah.
So like, I mean, compared to when I was training, 12 years ago and everyone was in the hospital for 4 days and all pain and what you're doing now, I visit you and you're doing 12 joints before lunch or whatever it is. And
that's not me.
So Barron was 12 before lunch, you were 6 before lunch or whatever. But, people are, it's a light year change what we're doing now to what we're doing 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? We can't be sort of so smug to think that we've sort of ceilinged out. Like, I wonder what we'll be doing how much more improvement is there? There can't be that much. I mean, so the operation we've got anatomically down probably as elegantly in operation as you could possibly do.
Yeah.
I guess the materials could improve. Pain could improve. But, I wonder, if some people think in 10 years' time you walk into a hospital and a bunch of robots will descend on you. where do you think things will be in 10, 15 years' time, and how much, no one knows, but are we all going to be, on a robotic factory, or is it going to be quicker recovery, or you can't make your incision much smaller. Your hip incision's about, what, it's like 3 inches. You can't, you have to physically put an implant into somebody.
Yeah, right. The implants, it's not like it's going to expand inside there. And you need to be able to see what you're doing and get the tools in.
I have to interrupt you about that, but I had a podcast with Rand Schwarzkopf.
Yeah. The Shack Chat.
Yeah. And his philosophy, his take is that there'll be a lot more technology on verifying, checking, guiding, which I guess in some ways is a good thing, but then does a surgeon become de-skilled and become just an operator of a machine? Where will we be in 10, 15 years?
I guess to me, like robotics, it's never, any literature that I've ever seen has been shown to be more accurate than what you and I do with
currently, but
calipered kinematic alignment, right? I'm just talking about knee replacements, but yeah, you're right. And verification is great. Is it going to make clinical differences? And is that going to make our patients do that much better? I think, to me, it's going to be a lot of, the biggest things for our patients right now, particularly for a knee, are like the patient's knees, they swell, right? Mm-hmm. They have pain and they get stiff knees because of this pain swelling cascade. So I think Andrew Wickline's onto something. We've done some, Andrew came and visited probably 4 or 5 years ago and he was telling me his protocol. I'm like, we're doing this. Like, my first 3 weeks, my patients, they're flat on their backs with their feet above their heart 80% of the time with some type of wrap on their leg to help control swelling. Because I feel like if you can control swelling in a knee, you can help minimize pain, improve range of motion, and improve satisfaction. So I think a lot of stuff will be geared towards pain reduction, swelling reduction, maybe some of the other postoperative narcotic side effects like nausea, things that are just unpleasant. So to me, it's about the experience. I'm not this big tech guru guy that's going to jump on every robotic bandwagon. I'm not using, augmented reality. I think it's cool, but I'm not doing it yet. I think it's about, for me, when patients walk in the door, I want them to be, when they walk in, I want to reduce their anxieties. And when they walk out, I want them to be like, that was actually, as weird as it may sound, a pleasant experience. As pleasant as a major operation can be, right? From like the hospitality that we provide to them, to the care that we provide to them, to the education that we provide to them. So that's my personal goal and mantra, but I do think technology is going to be a big player.
But there's some sort of new material we haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, right. Instead of metal and plastic.
Metal and plastic. I mean, it seems, they're not building jets out of metal and plastic. Well, I guess metal, but where material science might go.
Yeah.
Is the soil in the knee due to a nickel allergy that we didn't pick up?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, but 10 years ago we wouldn't have been where we are now. No one foresaw how much improvement, how quickly.
Yeah.
Whether we're going to plateau now, or whether we're going to be doing something radically different that makes this currently look primitive.
Yeah, I think we're kind of in the phase of splitting hairs a bit. Like people are pretty darn happy, but there's still definite room for improvement, no doubt. So personal questions? And by the way, we're going to drink some Italian red wine here. So give me your glass here. This is a Rosso di Montalcino 2021 Il Poggione. Is that how you pronounce that?
I'm not sure.
But I'm sure it's going to be good.
Yeah. I guess my personal question, you booked out for your searches booked out for a couple of months.
Yeah, about 6 months.
You obviously have the capacity, if you wanted to be working harder now, right? You could rather than having those patients waiting until May, you could be, operating until 5 p.m. rather than finishing up at 2 p.m. So I guess getting that balance right of being satisfied and financially happy, but still back home to go to sports. Like that's getting, because a lot of young guys will grab every possible case, will flog themselves. And some older surgeons, I know there's a couple of older surgeons who are also like working 6 days a week, operating on Saturdays. Some orthopods are notorious for burning the midnight oil and just being compulsive workers and getting that kind of.
Yeah. I mean, I'll start to answer this. I don't want to interrupt, but like, by no means am I slacking,
Oh, no, God, no.
Because doing close to 800 joints a year is, but cheers.
Yeah, no, I didn't imply that.
I'm just saying,
at some point you got to get the balance of you're working pretty hard, you being efficient, but you make the judgment that you're going to sort of stop because you got to go to a ball game. Like it's getting that personal balance right. I've personally found quite tricky is getting the sweet spot where you're busy working hard, but then, not taking that extra case.
And you're right. I think you learn throughout your career. Like early on, I can do more. I told you today, I used to do 65 patients in a day. And I come out of there wiped out, come home, and I didn't want to talk to anybody because I just talked to 65 people, had to solve 65 problems, more than 65 problems, because people have more than one problem or issue. And I was emotionally exhausted, and quite frankly, I just went through a period of professional burnout and what's diagnosed as compassion fatigue, where I was just like, I don't care about everybody's problems anymore. Like, why do I have to solve everybody's problems when like no one's here to ask me how I'm doing, right? And we have identified that in the United States, I'm sure this is a worldwide issue, but particularly in the United States, physicians are getting out of medicine at alarming rates, more so than ever in history. Physician burnout is at an all-time high. And last year was the first time, physicians are now the number one suicide of all professionals. It used to be dentists, and now it's physicians. And of physician suicides, it's orthopedic surgeons.
I've read that.
28.2%, almost a third. Yeah. Are us people who love their jobs, have fun. They're getting to fix problems and make people happier. But it's a combination of increased work burdens, increased responsibilities, EMR, headaches, declining reimbursement. So devalue, right? We were talking just about, and it's not about, I don't do what I do to make a lot of money. That I think that anybody that does what they do because they want to focus on the money, they're going to be inevitably unhappy. To me, I think we should be rewarded and we should be taken care of and we shouldn't just survive. We should thrive because we go to school for a very long time. We take people's lives in our hands. It is a huge responsibility, but don't pay me less every year. Like today, it just went through 2.83% Medicare cut for 2025. We take 3% cuts every year from our Medicare, our national healthcare system.
Well, you'll be paid less next year than you this.
Yeah.
So inflation, CPI, everything's going up.
Going up.
And your pay is going down.
Going down. So 20 years ago, 25 years ago now, the average reimbursement for me to do your hip or knee, a professional fee was $8,000. Okay. Now they don't write a check to Ryan Molly. They write the check to Whole Health. I pay all my staff, which 35 people. I pay my rent. I have two offices, actually three offices. I have three x-ray machines. I have all the malpractice insurance for all the providers, all the healthcare, which we talked about, which is different in Australia. you don't have like a benefit of healthcare. And I think people just take that for granted here. It's like, you just get that, right? They don't think that that's a nice extra. They just, it's expected almost. And that goes up about 20 to 25% every year. Medical supplies went through the roof during COVID. So everything is getting more expensive. They have reduced our reimbursement. Now it's $1,100 for me to do a hip or knee replacement in 20, 25 years. And we got better, way better than we were 20, 25 years ago, right? People are going home the same day, minimal pain, but they're going to pay me less, but they pay the hospitals more. So it's like they're driving people out of medicine. They're driving people to suicide. And it's, again, it's not all about the money, but that's a huge factor. People don't want to continue to do more work for less money. I mean, no one would sign up for that, right? So what was your original question? It was the balance, right?
Getting the balance right.
Yeah. You know. So for me, I saw all this stuff happening to my colleagues and personally experienced it. So I was like, I need to make sure that when I come home, I can be really, really good to my wife and really good to my boys and be present for them. And because they're more important than anybody I see or operate under. That doesn't mean that I don't take it very, very seriously. But at the end of the day, they're the ones here supporting me, listening to my issues, listening to my problems. They're my nucleus. So I got to be good for them and be good for myself and love myself. And if I'm burning myself out by doing 12 cases by noon, I have no desire to do that, right? That's number one. I would never even remember the cases that I did at the beginning of the day. 6 or 7 for me is my sweet spot. I think you kind of find what your sweet spot is as a surgeon. And but more than that, it's like exhausting to me. It's just not fun. Yeah. What else personally? And then we'll switch to you.
Nothing on the tip of my tongue. I'll think of most to ask you. Yeah.
So at what point, I know you mentioned that German orthopedic trauma surgeon was kind of like the person that influenced you to do orthopedics, but I know your dad is an anesthesiologist. What age was it? Your dad, was it someone else that was like, I want to do medicine? Was there what was the light bulb moment for you?
A pretty medical family. So my father's an anesthesiologist, my sister's a physical therapist, my mother's a psychologist. So that's what I knew, what I was exposed to. In South Africa, it's different to here. You could just bring your kid to work day. So as a kid, I went and watched surgeries. And it was like you taking your kids to work, and that was totally fine. In Australia, they were never flying in Australia, but in South Africa, that was just, you know, hey, do you want to come watch a case?
How old were you when you first watched surgery?
Probably 8.
Oh,
you just go to work day with your dad. So it's what I knew. There was, it's also a little bit different in the way the high school works is that you get like a rating score from your high school performance. You don't just go into a college, you kind of go, it's changing a little bit, but you go directly into a degree. And so there's a bit of pressure if you did really well to like not waste your score.
Sure.
So it's like there's pressure. And also, you know, I guess in the Jewish community, there's pressure to like be a doctor or be a lawyer. So there's some of that. That's just, I guess, what I knew, like, and then what my best friends were doing. We're all going to go into medicine together. But then didn't take long to realize that I didn't want to be a physician. I didn't want to be an anesthesiologist. I just didn't want to have the constant comparison. You know, you end up just meeting people who then influence it. And then you said before, like, I was asking about building stuff. Like, I was the kid who would like take radios apart and take little model toy cars apart. And back then, probably not fix them very well, but it's just this curiosity of how things work.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
Yeah. Broke a lot of toys, but I broke a lot of indestructible toys. My parents would buy things that were guaranteed were child safe, indestructible, and found a way to deconstruct it pretty fast. So either guy would be building the sort of crazy Lego set, or you'd have a stationary, like a stationary holder for school that you'd built yourself with little pencil compartments and stuff.
Yeah,
you know, just kind of like how things work, what makes things tick. So I guess, I mean, I probably would have been an engineer.
Yeah,
something.
That's usually a question I ask is like, all right, while you're there, answer that question. But you already said engineer, so if you couldn't be a surgeon, couldn't be an engineer, what would you do?
I had this dream for ages to be a professional tennis player. I was nowhere near good enough. I wasn't even like, I was never going to be anything more than just like a decent club player. But you had this sort of like psychotic dream that you're going to be an athlete.
I was going to be the next Michael Jordan. That didn't work out.
You know, I followed Stefan Edberg, and this is what I was going to do. Without realizing that these guys were in a different level. But then you actually realize, actually, you know, you're not an athlete. You're just a semi-smart kid.
That likes to play tennis.
And yeah, opportunities open, and you things sometimes fall into your lap a little bit. And I guess, like, you know, I had no idea about anterior hips until I landed up just being told to go on a weekend conference. Like, you know, sometimes you just get little light bulb moments which make you think, like, shit, this is actually what I want to do.
Yeah, that's how it was for me too. First surgery I ever saw was a hip replacement. I was like, wait a second, I get to use. I'm getting called mallets when I was observing. I was like, he's using a hammer, right? And he's pounding this piece of metal down into this big bone, the femur. Yeah. And I was like, that's pretty cool. Because I liked woodworking. So it seemed very natural to me. He's using a saw. So it made it just a natural next step for me, I guess.
Yeah, it's hard to go home now. You've got to, you know, put a painting on the wall and the drill bit's not sharp.
Yeah,
and there's no one. Then you put your hand out, and your partner looks at you like, "I'm not your scrub nurse."
And they hand it to you really awkwardly. They hand it to you like they're holding it where you need to hold it. Yeah. And I joke with my wife. I'm like, "Man, you would not be a good scrub tech." She's like, "Well, that's because I'm not a scrub tech."
Yeah, you have to just, you know, not being like thoughtless, but you kind of go surgeon mode at home sometimes.
And
you know.
So. We talked quite a bit about today, like the differences in healthcare in the United States versus Australia. I mean, there are some similarities. Like you have your public system, then you have your private system and things like that. But what would you say? I mean, you got to see Dr. Barron operate yesterday, myself today, just the conversations that we had too. What would you say the biggest differences between like medicine in Australia versus the United States and the goods and the bads of both?
Yeah, so our system is we basically have like Canada and America running side by side. You can be public, so you can go like Canada, or you can be privately insured. If you are privately insured, we're not constricted to what the insurance companies pay. So we have a lot more liberty to set our fees. So insurance company can pay X, and I'm like, well, thank you, but I charge Y, and the patient can pay the difference. So there's more, probably a bit more autonomy. In Australia, that we're not told that our pay is being cut 3%, etc. But the biggest difference is as I said to you, we were a very very heavily physician based system, to the point being where a lot of, I guess, less cerebral jobs are still only physician performed. You know, my surgical assistant is a physician. You only have, you know, every operating room and need to have, you know, one anesthesiologist per room. So it's expensive. It's expensive to run that kind of system. And I think the what we spend on health is too expensive. And we don't have some of the efficiency gains that you guys know. It's pretty much illegal to be operating in more than one room. So, like, you know, I have a lot of downtime. You know, I'll finish a case, they'll have to clean the room, they have to sort of do the next anesthetic. So even though I'm being reimbursed better, I'm not getting through the number of the volume that you guys do. So some of the efficiency gains that you guys have here, I think, are really good. You know, I think you use physician time better. You know, you don't need to be literally positioning and prepping your patient. You want to be, you know, you've done school for God knows how many years, you want to be operating.
Yeah.
So some of the efficiency stuff here, I think, is really good. Like, I'd like to reproduce that. But I think also, I like the autonomy and the we don't have what do you call it when you have to get sort of pre-authorization?
Oh yeah,
yeah. We don't. You know,
that's horrible.
What we bill the insurance company, they trust that you're the physician, and that's what they'll pay. You know, so, you know, for example, like, and some people take the piss a little bit. Like, there might be, for example, there's like a code for like a primary knee replacement. There's a code for like a complex knee replacement. And the onus is on you as a surgeon to declare that honestly. Yeah. Some guys will put down that every case I do,
everyone was complex. Everyone
is complex. So I mean, there is a bit of abuse like that, unfortunately. But the trust is that you're the physician, you're the honest one, you're going to bill appropriately. But there's less government and less insurance interference. Yeah, the more you can put it, every time you do a consult, you can charge the government. So even though you're in private practice is still heavily subsidized by the government. The insurance company actually pays a top up on it. But on one touch of a button on my computer system, my secretary will say, consult performed, and within immediately, I think it's almost instant, I get paid.
Can you determine how much you get paid for that consultation?
No.
Schedule?
You can choose whatever you can pay, you can bill whatever you want. What you get paid by the insurance or by the government is a fee schedule.
Okay.
So you can, some guys want to be sort of high volume, nothing out of pocket, they'll just charge that fee. Most people be like, no, I'm a boutique private surgeon, my fee is X. But what you charge the government amount is literally I'll get paid and patients will be reimbursed before they've got down to their car. Like it's all electronic. It's all instant.
So ours is so drawn out.
Yeah.
I mean, our accounts receivable, if you get paid within 30 days, you're doing really good. A lot of times it's between 30 and 60 or 90 days.
Yeah, and I'll get paid instantly, which is with any system like that where the physician has a lot of power on what you bill, there'll be the odd bad apple who'll, cause a problem. So like there's no perfect system.
Sure. But I would say if you spoke to 90% of the United States physicians, they say we have a crisis in this country. Patients don't realize that there's a crisis. Yeah. They will within the next couple of years. Would you say you guys have a crisis in your country?
No, there's a cost problem. The government doesn't want to charge more taxes. So rather than charging an extra tax on health, there's now a levy, right? Which is a tax by stealth. You'll pay your taxes and you'll pay your levy.
What's the difference?
Nothing.
It's just a different word.
So, there's definitely healthcare is expensive. And the issue as well is the cost of healthcare is, some of the new dressings or some of the new sort of prothrombotic agents like Tisiel and stuff. Like there's more and more and more technology and more options. And it's the cost of healthcare is going up and up and up and
sure.
up. And the government purse is going to at some point, they just can't afford to just keep on paying. So they try to restrict the number of practitioners, or they'll try to restrict the number of actual procedures. They'll try and do things to control the spend.
Well, I think one of the things that you mentioned too is your system runs solely. If someone wants to see you for hip or knee problems, they have to have a referral from a primary care doctor.
Yeah, correct.
They're the gatekeeper, so to speak.
Yes, there's a lot of gatekeeperness in many aspects.
Whereas that's not necessarily the case here. If you had hip pain, you could call my office tomorrow and we'd get you in.
Yeah. So in the public system, for example, there'll be a guarantee on, there'll be a government guarantee on what the wait list time for surgery is. So I think the guarantee is, they'll guarantee if you're a category two, which is a certain level of disability, they'll guarantee that the wait list is 90 days. But what they don't tell anybody is that it'll take you 6 or 9 months to get the appointment in the public clinic. So you'll wait 9 months for your appointment, from which you'll then wait 90 days. But effectively, you're waiting a year.
It's a year.
But they'll very carefully make sure that those clinics are not well-funded, because if they were well-funded, there'd be too many patients on a waiting list, which would then make them look bad politically. So, it's people love bashing America. We have our own nuances and our own problems, that the wait list time to get into a public clinic is intentionally huge so that they can then promote a reasonably quick wait list. We have our own, yeah.
So, I mean, you've traveled the world. Yeah. We were talking at dinner how you've been everywhere other than kind of South America. You were born in South Africa. You currently live in Melbourne and practice there. Yeah. Would you ever consider leaving, or is Australia your home, and do your future professionally, is it what you want it to be?
Yeah, I think. I mean, professionally, on a practical level, I think you literally just can't. There's very little medical reciprocity between countries, which is by design. They don't want to have an influx of foreign doctors here or elsewhere. But I think overall Australia is good. You know, the quality of life is good. Weather's good. We're very far removed from the world's problems. So the biggest issue is environmental stuff, or you know, we don't have a lot of major social issues. So it's peaceful. My kids can take a train to the city at night, and you know, crime levels are low, gun ownership low, gun crime is low.
Yeah, we talked about that today, and I remember when I was in Australia in 2017, like people thought it was insane that I owned guns.
Yeah. So it's a little bit frustrating because you're trying to engage an Australian into discussing like problems in the Middle East. Their attitude is, you know, war's bad. You know, the average Australian is very removed from the world's problems, which makes it a nice place to live. It can make it a little bit sort of mentally dull because people just don't give a shit about anything else other than you know, we need more wind farms. Yeah, so like it can be a little bit frustrating if you are a bit worldly and you live there and the average person is not, they don't realize the world's bigger than what they see.
Sure.
You know, there'll be a campaign, you know, because the government will have emailed everybody pushing, you know, 4-minute showers, and everyone will receive a little, literally they email like a little timer, so you may put in your shower so that you feel good that you kept your shower to 4 minutes. And like their biggest focus is on, you know, environmental stuff, which is not a bad thing, but you know, people cut, it sometimes feels like you're more about trees than about people. Like it's the focus is, it's just not on the same issues that as a non-Indigenous born person might care about.
One thing I've been impressed with, but
it's not a bad problem to have, to live in that kind of like politically dull.
You're a little bit of a bubble, but you personally, I was tremendously impressed with your worldly knowledge. Like we were talking about the Electoral College upstairs, and you knew more than my wife and I combined about how the whole process works here in the States. And you knew the governor of Pennsylvania. And by the way, my wife this is the first episode I think she's ever done this. Yeah. Maybe it's because you came all the way from Australia just for this podcast, but she has dessert for us.
Thanks very much.
So here she comes. She wanted some camera action, I think.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Is it pumpkin or? Yeah. Awesome.
Do you?
Thank you. Yeah, awesome. Thank you.
Do you have pumpkins in Australia?
A little bit. Yeah, we kind of find them in Halloween.
Yeah. So this is kind of a tradition around this time of year for us because
we've got much.
Thanksgiving coming up.
Yeah.
So you got to put the whipped cream on there. You get that little coating in there. That's going to be good. Is this from Wegmans, Karen? Oh, yeah, or Wegmans. So, again, you've traveled the world. Get into some personal stuff here. What is your favorite place that you've ever been and why? And like, what are the reasons? And what is a place that you haven't been that's like on your bucket list? It's kind of a two-part question, but it's only going to count for one.
I had a really good experience. I mean, I liked France, it was different. The food was simple. I was working with, you know, Frederick Lord, and it's just a totally different kind of way of operating. The culture, you would stop operating at lunch and have a 2-hour lunch break and with food and wine. And I think they got the balance of living. They live well.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a restaurant here and after a while you kind of get hassled, you know, is everything okay? And they're trying to move you on. There you could sit at a table for 4 hours and you wouldn't get bothered. So I think the Europeans live well in that way. That was fun. But I wouldn't want to, like, they have their own issue. I wouldn't want to.
Laissez-faire, right? Yeah. It's kind of the...
I want to get to Argentina at some point.
For the Malbec or?
The Malbec. I think there's a big Jewish community I want to see at some point.
Is there in Argentina?
I think Australia's a great base. It's just you've got to get out and travel or you kind of get a bit stale. But in terms of living, it's they even sort of like Melbourne's rated as the world's most livable city. I don't even know what that means for it to be livable. It just means it's a great place to live. But it's still fun to actually go and, you know, do a conference in Texas or go and ski in Japan or take the nice things out of other places and then realize you actually live in a good place yourself.
Or come to Northwest Pennsylvania for some pumpkin pie, right? Pumpkin pie and podcasts. That's what we do. Pumpkin pie
and podcasts, and eventually at some point, apparently deer shooting. So,
yeah.
Stuff I can't do at home.
Well, we could do a little bit, like, I don't remember which one of the Crocodile Dundees when they were out poaching at night with the spotlights and the kangaroo. This is a
knife, yeah.
Yeah, that's not a knife. This is a knife.
Yeah.
All right, so we talked a little bit about your kids, your daughters, they dance, your son does some kind of middle distance track and field, cross country type stuff. Yep. You played tennis growing up. What do you like to do with your kids for fun? Do you guys travel? Do you do athletics? What culture? What kind of stuff?
It's a little bit in flux. I actually separated last year, so I've got a new partner, she has kids, so kind of trying to still get the happy medium. But yeah, just realizing to sort of get out of the city and go and ride bikes and just unplug a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, kids are just basically on iPads and devices all the time. And then to just disconnect them, I think it's really important.
Is that hard? Are they like, because I know our boys, they all have devices, but we try to be reasonable with limits on that and try to, and fortunately, like before you got here, they were all outside playing. Like there's a bunch of neighborhood kids. They were playing 4-on-4 basketball outside and I was being the referee. So
yeah, that's not really a problem, but like, but just to have the discipline to, you know, get out of the city and go and ride bikes or took the kids up in June, July and went sort of snorkeling for a couple of days on the Great Barrier Reef. And, yeah, you know, it's difficult as a non-employed surgeon as in private practice. It's all fee for service, and you know the more you work, the more money you make, the more opportunities you have. So you can sort of the bigger house you can build, but then to sort of say, hang on a second, you know, I'm going to just take over. And if I take over a week of work, you know, my staff are still I've got staff sitting around, you know, taking some, you know,
because it's just you, right? You don't have any partners.
My setup is just me, so. And so my staff work just for me, and unless we coordinate our leave time, like right now, as in like literally right the second, I've got two secretaries sitting in an office and maybe the phone's ringing, maybe it's not, I've got no idea what they're doing. So it's hard to still take time.
Do you try to encourage them to take time when you take time?
Yeah, but you can't, we can't
force that.
Yeah. I mean, if I close the practice, like over Christmas, if I close the practice, then that's like a week of their leave.
Yeah.
But but I can't close the practice because someone can ring up with a complication or they want to make or they want to make an appointment to come see me when they're back. So I still want the practice open, but it's not making any money.
So here's just it's a work question. I know I'm done with those, but I'm going to go back to one. You're here, right? It's just you. Do you have somebody in your community that covers for you and vice versa?
Yeah. So at the hospital where I work, there's another surgeon who he's in a different practice than me, but we'll cross cover.
Okay. That's great.
Or if there's like, he does the wacky trauma stuff, like, you know, I had a patient who needed a MPFL reconstruction and a typical tubercle transfer. And I was like, I don't do that.
Yeah.
And he's one of these old school guys who doesn't say no. You know, you can have the biggest, worst complication, the worst possible patient.
How old is he?
He's in his 60s, but he probably looks like he's 50s or 60s, but he looks like he's a bit hardened. Like he's a kind of guy when I was
run hard, put away wet.
No, he was when I was training, he was one of my mentors, but he would be on call for three hospitals simultaneously.
Oh my gosh.
But that creates logistical problems because you have to be able to get to the three hospitals in case you get caught.
So you can't do two operating rooms at the same time. Would you be on call at three different hospitals at the same time?
Obviously he would have like a residence under him.
Sure.
But he would literally triangulate between the two hospitals and he'd park his car like that was equally triangulated. And then he would sleep in his car so that if you called him, he could be at any of the hospitals within whatever it was, like 25 minutes.
Wow.
And then he's a great mentor because he would like when you're training some attendings would let you cut and simultaneously would want to do everything themselves. He'd be the kind of, he'd come into the operating room and he would literally, because he's exhausted, he'd be like in the operating room in the corner with a cup of pillows.
Do this, do that.
No, no, no. He'd be sleeping. He'd be he'd be napping. He'd be present, but he'd be present but not interfering. And if you needed a hand, you would like wake him up.
Those are the best attendings, right?
And he'd have a look. And go, yeah. So here's my boss, but now he's my colleague. Good guy. He'll just fix shit.
Yeah.
So he's looking after my practice in case there's a problem. But
that's nice. Yeah, you can get away and just unplug a little bit.
Yeah. No. I mean, like legally and ethically, you have to have somebody who covers for you.
Okay. I figured.
And also make sure that I don't book the high-risk patients a week before traveling.
Sure.
You have to just moderate your schedule and do the chip shot cases before you travel. And stuff.
Yeah. So my last question, I'm going to go a little deep on you. That's okay, right. With this?
Yeah.
So if you could, at this point, you're 45, right?
Yeah.
If you could look back at your 25-year-old self and kind of give your 25-year-old self some wisdom that you've accumulated over, you know, your 45 years, personally and professionally, what would it be? And this is another two-part question, okay? That's the first part of it. The second part of it is, if you could, you're Jewish, I'm Roman Catholic, so this isn't a religious question, this is more of like a spiritual question, right? If you could talk to God and ask God one question, what would that be? So it's a two-parter.
Well, I have to just digest it for a second.
Take your time. So first part is 45-year-old self talking to 25-year-old self. Piece of advice, something that you learned that... Because me personally, I'm still pretty stubborn, still pretty bullheaded, but I'm way more open-minded. And there's one person to thank for that. That's the lady that brought us the pumpkin pie, Miss Karen Molly. She helped to kind of balance me out and allow me to see things from more than just my single perspective. And it was hard, and it still is hard, but she kind of grounds me and allows me to understand that there's more than one way to look at things.
I think when you're 25, you're focused on the technical job that you do. You want to be a good executor of a specific operation. You don't, certainly when we're training, you don't get taught the people skills and the expectation setting skills. And you were saying, for example, you tell every patient that they're going to be numb.
Yeah.
You don't get like some of the, so I think when I first come out of training is you kind of promoting yourself and you think patients, everything's going to be great. And you kind of, you probably don't learn the expectation management. And so, you had a patient where you didn't mean to, but you get the leg length a bit wrong and then they're sort of pissed at you. And I think you'd really learn to manage people. We don't get taught that. We get taught to do a procedure.
Yeah.
And
cut here, do this, do this.
And you also learn the patients who come into your clinic at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, don't take their sunglasses off. Like you can now who within 3 seconds the radar goes up and you kind of learn that these patients need to be mental health checked, they need to be managed, they need to be optimized. Whereas when you're just finishing,
you operate on anybody.
That's saying that if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
Right. So I think you definitely are, and also you a surgeons around conferences who say, "Oh, I never get an infection," or either they're not operating or they're bullshitting.
Yeah.
You actually realize that the best surgeons I visited will have fuck ups or problem. So you learn to be a lot more. I think you learn humbleness.
Yeah.
With no one teaches you to be we're not taught as surgeons inherently to be humble. We're taught to be sort of egotistical. The humbleness comes with time and wisdom, I think.
And complications, right? There's nothing more humbling than something that's supposed to go well that doesn't go well. Yeah. And
but ironically, not ironically, but now if I get complications, which I still do, patients tolerate that a lot better because you're probably the way you, you know, the way you're presenting yourself the first time, the way you expect, you know, the way you, your rapport with patients is definitely better with time.
Sure.
And it wipes the smugness. So when you've had a, you know, a malpractice case or you've had a tough case or something, it kind of wipes the smug factor off you a little bit and you learn to just be a bit real.
Yeah.
And I think patients appreciate that.
Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something, especially with like that, everything you said, but that expectation thing is, if there's one thing I've seen just professionally is I almost, like early on, you're right, you're almost like a salesman. You're like, I'm going to do this anterior hip. I'm not going to cut any muscles. I'm not going to cut any tendons. You're going to have minimal pain. You're going to have a really quick recovery. And now I'm like, you're going to be numb. You're going to be sore. You're going to be this. You're going to be that. And I tell all my patients this because for some reason they have this expectation that we surgeons, we're going to make them better than, I'm going to have you pull that back in just so, yeah. I say, I can't take away 100% of your pain in your hip or your knee. I said, my goal is if I can take away 70 to 75% of your pain in your hip or your knee, that's a huge accomplishment. So setting that low bar, and I think oftentimes it's over exceeding that. Maybe it's 90, 95% pain relief. But to tell them 100%, you're setting yourself up for success and you're setting them up for disappointment.
Yeah.
So what about the second part of that question? Whether you believe in whatever, your higher power, right? If you could speak to God and ask God one question, right? Like, why me? Why this? Why? What would it be?
I don't know. So like, I separated last year, right? And you try and do your best. You try and be like, you know, the best husband or the best father, and I think it don't work out. Which is like that was a huge sort of like shock because you just don't see like shit like that. So you sort of wonder like, you know, you try and do your best, but like why do you have to deal with sort of like, or like bad shit?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. So sometimes you get, or like my new partner's like, mum died. Like, you know, you believe in God and you, but why does really bad shit happen to good people?
Yeah. That's a hard.
Yeah. And no one knows the answer to that, but
no.
Like, that's sometimes you kind of struggle with like.
Do your kids ever ask you that stuff? Cause I ask myself and I ask God those kind of questions all the time. Like,
or
why?
Yeah, or you'll see like you know, something horrific, like some terrorist attack, where like some young, sweet, good-looking girl just why does terrible stuff happen?
Yeah,
to other people, of course, and then when it comes to you, you're like, well, you know, fuck, what have I done for this?
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of times, at least from my perception, really, really shitty stuff happens to really good people, too. Right, like. Crappy stuff happens to bad people too, but the harder things for me are like when you've got, like, for instance, I had a very good high school friend of mine, one of the nicest guys in the world, Jake Boyle, love you. He's up somewhere now looking down on us, but had brain cancer, was an amazing student, was an amazing athlete, was an amazing, successful, he was a great friend, tremendous baseball player, had the world by the balls, and he had brain cancer, and it's just like, why Jake? And you know, someday hopefully I'll know the answer, but those are hard things, like philosophical questions. And I guess my take from a lot of those things is I firmly believe that like God brought you to it and God will bring you through it. So it's like not going to put anything more on your shoulders than he or she or whatever it is you believe in can carry. Right. And that just kind of helps to comfort me with it. Cause there's a lot of times heavy stuff happens, right? Yeah. Whether it's separation from your spouse, whether it's something at work doesn't go well, death in the family. And you're like, and oftentimes they compound.
Yeah. I don't like when like something bad happens and someone else will try and rationalize it. Oh, this happened because they did this, or you know, the Holocaust happened because, like, you know, that kind of grates me. We just we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
But it kind of like, and you can, you know, it's, yeah. So like we have a huge, you know, we have a huge post-Holocaust population in Melbourne. And some people, some families got through that and they became more religious. They increased their faith. But a lot of people kind of went, you know, I'm done with religion. You know, like there's a level of bad shit which is just incompatible with there being a God.
Yeah.
So, and you can't judge that, you know, you can't judge someone who's been through absolute hell and thinks, well, this, you know, this is incompatible with there being, you know, it's, you can, I've seen people go both ways on, after, you know, terrible experiences. Some people find faith, some people lose faith, and you can't judge them for it.
No. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I'm done with questions, but I'm going to ask another one. That's so, actually, I'm gonna save that question because we do a little bit of a challenge here. And instead of doing the typical challenge, I wanna mix it up a little bit. One thing we always do on this particular podcast, the Hey Sawbones one, is you saw my shoe collection, right? So I'm a huge shoe guy. You're wearing a unique pair of shoes, probably not for you, but I asked you, like, what do you call those boots? And you're like, eh, I don't know. It's
shoes.
But like this is not an American thing. Like this, they kind of look like cowboy boots, but they're low and they have this this. Stretchy material here. Like, what is that style called?
I don't know. It's just, this is what guys wear.
In Australia, though, they don't wear those in the United States. Right. Very rarely.
Yeah, we're not into sneakers so much.
Yeah.
We're kind of like sort of nice, dressy shoes, but I don't know. I was told to not come back from Dallas without cowboy boots. So I don't know. I didn't even realize it was interesting.
I guess, is this a particular brand that you have of this shoe?
No, it's just, I mean, I have a pretty wide foot, but...
What type of leather is this? Do you know?
No.
You know?
No, I'm not like into shoes so much, but it's just, I hate sitting there with tying up laces and...
Yeah. But this is, when I was in Australia, this is what everyone was wearing. It's like a slip-on... It looks comfy. Are they comfy?
Yeah, very.
Is this comfy. What you wear in the OR?
I used to until I got a new girlfriend. She said, "Oh, you have to look after your feet," and now I have like really nice, you know, Nikes and good sneakers and stuff.
Okay,
but I wear them all the time.
Yeah, well, I like the look. As I mentioned when I was there,
I've sent you some shoes.
My luggage didn't make it to me until the very last city in Adelaide, very southern Australia. And I was trying to fit in, right? Like, went in Rome, do as the Romans do. Went in Australia, do as the Australians do. So I bought a bunch of clothes that didn't fit me very well. I'm a bigger guy, taller guy. And the clothes were much tighter than I would have worn back then or even now. And I was like, well, I'm going to get some of these. But I saw these. I'm like, dang, they're really expensive. Yeah. So I was like, I'll just get a knockoff pair. And they were so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that you get what you pay for. Yeah. I'm obviously wearing the standard Jordans here, Jordan 1s. But my question here, this is kind of our Sawbones challenge. We do a little challenge. We typically play basketball or something like that. And we can do that if you want. But do you watch movies at all?
I do.
Or are you more of a music person?
No, I watch movies, but Hollywood grates me. I can't watch another Richard Gere Hollywood stuff. So like I will I think so with Netflix now, like I'd always go to like, you know, the Italian Film Festival or the French Film Festival and see something that was a little bit different. Now at least with sort of with streaming you can seek out sort of art movies and stuff. I can't watch another Julia Roberts film or mass produced. I don't like mass produced anything.
Sure.
Movies, food, I mean, even
medicine.
I mean, even music now. Like I didn't touch your music in your operating room, but in my operating room, I'll have really eclectic stuff.
So I played rock today because
that was good. But you come to my operating room and you probably won't hear much English.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you understand it, or is it just the music?
No, just world music.
Okay.
Like there's a South African artist. He kind of got famous because he's called the Kiffness. There was that song which came popular in America where he had Trump going, you know, "I'm eating the dogs." Have you heard that song?
I've heard it, yeah.
But that just became popular in America. But like he takes like Mongolian throat singers, and he remixes it and just quirky stuff, like wacky, quirky stuff.
But. So if you had a favorite band that I would maybe know, who would it be?
Probably like Hozier. I like the stuff that you're playing. I like Metallica and Guns N' Roses and that kind of stuff. But the stuff I listen to now would be quirky, off mainstream.
Yeah.
So that you'd be like scratching your head, being like, I play music pretty loud. So my operating room is just interesting music coming out of it.
Was it louder than what we were playing today?
Yeah. but then my dad, who's my anesthesiologist, will go and turn it down and he'll change it. But it's kind of like, you know, I guess it's good to be the boss. Yeah. As the surgeon, you're like, well, this is what we're listening to. You know, everyone's listening to African music today and they can. Yeah, you know, they can shake their heads and scratch their ears and doesn't matter. Yeah.
So that is one of my favorite things about being kind of like the captain of the ship is you get to pick the music. Like I've been in some hours, well, you were in Keith Barron's hour and Lombardi's the same way, no music. Yeah. And I've been in some where it's like, what do you want to listen to today? I'm like, hell no, it's what I'm going to listen to. Like I'm the one that's like doing cutting today. My favorite band of all time is Pink Floyd, hands down. So I like some of that psychedelic stuff. I like a lot of the long instrumentals where there's not a lot of lyrics because it just, to me, doing surgery, and you probably noticed this today. I don't know how you are doing surgery, but I don't generally talk a lot when I operate. It's kind of like, I don't know if you ever watched Tiger Woods play golf, but when Tiger Woods is on Sunday playing golf and he's wearing his red polo shirt, you don't talk to him. You let him do his thing because he's going to go win a golf tournament. And one of my staff said that to me, like, when Molly's operating, it's like Tiger Woods on Sunday with red on. Don't talk to him. It's just like, let him do his thing because it's like, that's my little world. So today I actually talk more than I generally ever talk because you were there. But usually it's a pretty quiet environment. It doesn't mean that it's high stress. It's just people just know I'm just lasered in, just kind of doing my thing.
Yeah, I probably talk a bit like I work with different assistants to talk about their weekend or their kids or
but small talk. Chit-chat,
small talk.
Yeah, it's not like I need this, right?
No. Once you have a good team, it's like
an orchestra.
It's like doing a tango.
Yeah.
You know, you're operating, your hand goes out. That's when you really appreciate a good scrub nurse, is when they're not there. Because then it's not in your hand or that's the wrong instrument. But when you're on song and it's just like you're dancing and it's
that's the beauty of surgery, isn't it? Yeah,
very satisfying.
Yeah, you're right. It's like a beautiful tango. It's a beautiful orchestra. You watch a sports team that's just performing at their peak, right? There's no flaws. Yeah. There's little hiccups here and there, but it's just beautifully orchestrated. Yeah. So, well, Elon, I just want to thank you for...
No, thank you for your hospitality. It's been really fun.
You know what we need to do, though? Yeah. We need to go watch some election results, finish this bottle of wine, and go Trump. So again,
I don't disagree, but I gotta.
And he voted for Trump. So, all the viewers out there, thank you for tuning in. I urge you to hit the like button, hit the subscribe button, leave comments, leave suggestions.
Tell me all about it, Doc.
As a disclaimer, This podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions.